This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mel Torme has been performing for 66 of his 70 years. He made his way from child star to top-billed entertainer. Many of his recordings from 1944 to 1985 are collected in a new box set on Rhino Records. Although Torme is best known for his singing, he's also an arranger, pianist, drummer, actor, and songwriter. He wrote the Christmas song, the one that starts "Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire." I spoke with him in 1988 after the publication of his autobiography, It Wasn't All Velvet, a reference to his nickname, The Velvet Fog. Let's first listen to a 1956 recording from the new box set. This is Something's Gotta Give.
When an irresistible force such as you meets an old immovable object like me, you can bet as sure as you live, something's gotta give, something's gotta give, something's gotta give.
Mel Torme has been performing since the age of 4, so he was performing during the time his voice changed. I asked him if that gave him any problems.
It did as a radio actor. I was a child radio actor from 1934 to about 1940. And when my voice did change, all those real kids' parts that I had, I was in that strange transitional period vocally where I wasn't being offered as many child radio acting parts as I had in the past. But by that time, I was so immersed in jazz and the playing of drums, in singing, even in this, you know, sort of 14-year-old froggy voice of mine, that really, I didn't really notice too much in the way of transition. Everything seemed to just kind of shift gears and go, I would say, rather smoothly.
Mm-hmm. You were on the road, I think, for the first time when you were about 17 with the Ben Pollock Band. And what was it like to be 17 playing with a lot of guys who were, for the most part, considerably older than you were?
It was tough. And by the way, Ben Pollock put that band together, Terry, but it was the Chico Marx band, you know, the Marx brother who played piano and used to shoot the keys when he zipped up the upper scale of the piano. It was tough. I got a lot of comeuppance, as they say in the Magnificent Ambersons, and some of it was deserved, frankly. Some of it wasn't, but I can look back now and realize that it was the natural progression of youth, you know, puberty, adolescence, and you finally get to be a young man, and then you get to be an old man if you live long enough.
What did you have to do to prove yourself?
I think, well, a couple of things. First of all, as I mentioned, and It Wasn't All Velvet, they were absolutely determined to see me finally and irrevocably lose my virginity. And the whole band seemed to be in on this, and it finally happened in Pittsburgh with a very lovely woman who was considerably older, not considerably, but somewhat older than myself. And, no, wait a minute, I guess considerably. I was 17, she was about 34. But generally speaking, I think the only way you can prove yourself with the older element of a band like that when you're as young as I was literally to keep on keeping on, to just keep learning, to try to do better all the time, and to prove yourself by virtue of your professionalism.
Well, when you were playing a song for Glenn Miller, Miller said to you, don't write Moon, June, Spoon kind of lyrics. What effect did that have on you? Did that make you think more about rhymes?
Oh, absolutely. Not about rhyme. Not about rhyme. Because that's not what he was talking about. He was talking about content.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about making pictures with lyrics. And he recommended that I listen to every lyric that Johnny Mercer had ever written. And he was absolutely right. Mercer became my role model as a songwriter and lyric writer particularly. And I began to realize that you could write something, I don't want to say profound, but redemptive in the popular song field without literally leaning on the tried and true narrow parameters of the popular song.
I want to ask you about a song that you wrote, a song you wrote early on in your career called Born to be Blue. Did you write this after Glenn Miller gave you his little lecture?
Oh, yes, yes. At least, I think it was 4 to 5 years after I spoke to Glenn Miller. And I wrote that with Bob Wells, who was my songwriting partner.
That's true. You didn't write the lyric.
Well, no, that's not true. No. Bob Wells and I were a team in the purest sense of the word, because Bob was extremely musical as well as an extremely fine lyric writer. And I was purely a lyric writer as well, hopefully, as a composer of popular type song music. So when we worked together, even on the Christmas song and Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, he contributed to the melody, I contributed a lot of the lyrics. And that's the way we worked.
Let me play a recording that you made of your song Born to Be Blue in the mid-40s with Sonny Burke and his orchestra. And let's listen to a little of Mel Torme singing his own song, Born to Be Blue.
Some folks were meant to live in clover, but they are such a chosen few. And clover being green is something I've never seen, 'cause I was born to be blue. When there's a yellow moon above me, they say there's moonbeams I should view. But moonbeams being gold are something I can't behold, 'cause I was born to be blue.
We'll get back to our interview with Mel Torme after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1988 interview with Mel Torme. He has a new CD box set. Let's get back to the mid-1940s, around the time that the recording we just heard was made. You sang at the Copa in New York at that time. And this was a turning point for you in a way, kind of a bad experience. You'd gotten this big build-up as the Velvet Fog, which you were nicknamed by one of the New York DJs. And you thought that build-up really worked against you in performance.
I'm not so sure about performance, Terry, but I think it did work against me from the standpoint of the fact that I was sort of shoved down the New York collective throat. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of course, the critics, the people in the press media, the print media, they all said basically to the disc jockeys, quit inundating the airwaves with this guy and telling us that he's the greatest thing since chopped liver. We'd like to discover that for ourselves, not have you. There was great rivalry, particularly in those days, between the power of the so-called disc jockey and the press. Who was more influential? And I was kind of caught in the nutcracker.
You were also kind of caught in the middle of two generations, too, weren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I came onto the Copa stage at a time when the Copa was playing nobody except the considerably older performers, the Sophie Tuckers, the, you know, Joey Lewis's, Jimmy Durante. Those were the staples at the Copa. Now here comes this squirt from California, and he's going to entertain us? Come on. And consequently, I really got my lumps at the Copa, some of which, again, I deserved.
Well, you said you had to sing in a falsetto then, and listening to your records from the mid-40s, I don't hear what you mean.
No. I don't know where that came from, but I don't even know how to sing falsetto. As a matter of fact, you know, my range in the last several years has increased on the upper end as well as the lower end by at least 3 or 4, maybe 5 notes. And when I sing very high notes in some of the records that I've made with George Shearing and even on my own, some absolutely ill-informed critics say he even sounds good in falsetto. I can't produce. I don't know how to produce a falsetto note. What those notes are what singing teachers call covered tones. They're done up in the head, but they are absolutely pure. They have nothing to do with mechanical or ersatz formation of notes. I didn't sing in a falsetto way in those days, Terry, but I did sing in rather a wispy, kind of creamy, and I felt rather callow way. And consequently, I couldn't bear to hear the sound of my voice on records in those days. Not that I'm that wild about it today, but at least now I can tolerate, because of the aging process, because my voice has deepened, and because I think I've learned a little more about singing than I knew back in 1947 at the Copa, I can tolerate what I record on record.
Well, you said that you used to sing in a head tone, and now you're singing through with your diaphragm.
Right.
What's the difference between the two, and how did you start to change?
I think you mainly produce head tones, obviously, in the head. Breathing, of course, is everything in singing. But I taught myself to breathe from the diaphragm. And I can produce notes now that are very powerful. I'm a far, far more robust singer than I used to be in those days. And that is more pleasing to my personal ear. Beyond that, as I say, I taught myself my own sort of breathing exercise to the point where I can hold a note, for instance, at the end of a song almost interminably. And I think that's terribly important that you're able to control your breathing, particularly for phrasing of lyrics.
Well, here's what I want to do. I want to play a record you made in 1956 of Nice Work If You Can Get It, the Gershwin song. I don't know what you think about this recording, but we're about to find out. and I should mention, as you probably know, that this was singled out by the people who did the American Popular Song Anthology for the Smithsonian Collection of Recordings. And this is a collection of some of the greatest American popular songs. And they did their attempt to find the definitive recordings of these great songs. And so your recording of Nice Work If You Can Get It was chosen. This was made in 1956. I should say it's with the Marty Paich Dectet, which is the group that you are reunited with on right. your new record. So let's give this a spin and then see what you think of it.
Okay.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one girl, sighing sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just imagine someone waiting at the cottage door, where two hearts become one. Who could ask for anything more? Loving one who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how?
It's Mel Torme as recorded in 1956. So what do you think?
Not bad.
Yeah, I concur. Well,
I wasn't that terrible. No, actually, it sounds pretty good. I mean, let me put it this way. I was sort of hit and miss in those days because I was still earning my wings. My whole career, as I point out in this book of mine, is a work in progress. The learning curve is always there. Whitney Balliot did a big profile on me in the New Yorker magazine about 4 or 5 years ago. And when he asked me why all this wonderful stuff is happening for me right now, this tremendous renaissance of my career and everything, I looked him right in the eye and said, Whitney, I'm learning how to sing. And he really gave me a look that said, my God, what an ingenuous remark. I said, no, Whitney, don't look at me that way. I'm telling you point blank, I am learning how to sing. I do that, Terry, literally every day of my life. And that's not a phony modesty remark. I am, I think, on a daily basis, learning a little more about myself, learning how to be more consistent, how to concentrate more on what I sing. And I hope that's to the good.
Mel Torme recorded in 1988. There's a new 4-CD box set called the Mel Torme Collection on Rhino Records.
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and a nightingale sang. in Berkeley Square. I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear that when you turned and smiled at me, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square.
This is Fresh Air.